Welcome, everyone. You're here live at the IANS Conference in Westminster, Colorado. By the way, that's IANS standing for the International Association for Near-Death Studies. As you can imagine, the energy here at this conference is quite unique, but very, very powerful. And today, I am so pleased, so honored to have Marjorie Woollacott, an incredible speaker that I had the privilege of hearing this morning. And she's here to share her great wisdom and experience and very, very unique story. So this is Marcy Newman, your host of Heart Shift Radio, and we're ready to begin. Welcome, Marjorie.
Thank you, Marcy. It's wonderful to be here.
I'll tell you, listening to you this morning, this is going to sound strange, but I actually could feel this great sense of pride. Pride in, I guess, how far you've come and the contributions that you've made to this area of science. And I'd like very much if you could tell our audience how you started out. I know you started out actually as a music major, and then you made this extreme pivotal turn in your life, and then yet again. And I'm going to leave that suspense for a little bit later on in our discussion. So would you mind just telling our audience a little bit about how you came to that first step in an opposite direction?
Sure. First of all, I should say that being a music major was something that I had always wanted to do, and my teachers and my parents had encouraged me to do. I was an oboist as a young child, and at the same time, I knew I also...
Excuse me, which is unusual in itself,
which
right?
Which is unusual itself to be an oboist, that's right. From the time I was like 7 years old, I
did
music.
Oh my goodness.
And I went to USC as a music major, but I always knew I also wanted to be a neuroscientist. And I decided to do the music first, and then I would go on into my neuroscience career, which is exactly what I did. And I found that, in fact, there was something very beautiful about neuroscience and being a speaker and teacher in neuroscience, because in music, I found playing the oboe, you had to have every note exactly as it was written on the page by the composer. But in neuroscience, I could actually do a beautiful amount of improvisation. As I talked to people about different subjects, I could find out what they needed to hear in the moment and actually talk about that. And I should say, I also loved my neuroscience. However, when I began to take my neuroscience courses at the university, I realized that what all of my professors were saying is that this is a material world with no spiritual dimension to it at all, and that this is what they, quote unquote, knew about science, that we were people who were embodied beings with neurons in our brain actually creating our consciousness awareness. And they said, all of the evidence is out there to prove that there is nothing more than a material existence. And being a young neuroscience student, I read all the papers, I listened to my professors, and I became a materialist. And that means that all of my relatives and friends who happened to be somewhat spiritually oriented, I thought were weak-minded. And I would laugh at them behind their backs because I was a strong neuroscientist and I knew about materiality, et cetera, being the number one understanding of science. I should say then what happened is that in 1976, when I was about 30 years old and I had been a neuroscience graduate student and a postdoc and now was a new professor at a university in Virginia, my sister, who meditated, invited me to a meditation workshop given by an Indian meditation master. And this was up in the Catskill Mountains of New York. And I'm a scientist, and I'm skeptical, but I'm also curious. And it's my birthday, and she says, come on your birthday for this meditation intensive workshop, and it'll be my present to you. So I come, and on the first day of this intensive meditation workshop, we were told that the Swami was going to come around and initiate every person there individually by touch.
Stop right there.
Exactly.
Stop right there. Like Mr. Wonderful said, stop the madness. Exactly. So you willingly went into this situation that must have seemed bizarre to you. Like,
absolutely.
Could you relate on any level?
Well, you know, I think what it was is that, first of all, I was skeptical, but I was also curious. You know, a real scientist has a curiosity, and they want to see what will my experience be and what will my observation be. So in fact,
interesting.
Yeah, I think that's the key for everyone. If we all are curious, then we can make our own decision as we watch and see what we observe. And so what happened is that I decided, here, I'm here for the weekend, why not see what it happens? And in fact, when he came around to me, he touched me with his fingers and his thumb right between my eyes on the bridge of my nose. Again, amazing. And
I just have to just tell our audience, as Marjorie was speaking, I could feel what I call God bumps rising to the surface of my skin. This is recognition of the truth of what she's referring to.
Yes.
That visceral reaction.
And in fact, my eyes were closed, but I was absolutely alert when this was happening, and my senses were fully engaged. So when I felt what seemed like a mini current of electricity go from his fingers deep into my body, I had a sense of utter certainty about the event. And that's not to say that I knew precisely what was happening. To this day, I can't understand it. I can't really explain it completely, but what it felt like was a mini lightning bolt going from his fingers between my eyes, down to the center of my chest, and I could feel the exact place where it stopped.
Wow.
And it was my heart. And I don't mean my physical heart.
I
mean much more like a real heart than my physical heart had ever felt. And then this love, this joy, felt like golden nectar began radiating out from that place inside of me. And words came to mind, I'm home.
Wow.
My heart is my home.
And I can feel that.
Marjorie. Isn't that? I mean, that is our home.
Yeah.
And it was the first time in my life I had ever experienced it. And I say to my friends that what was most amazing to me about the workshop was really what happened afterwards, because I go back home to my university position in Virginia, and my habits turn around 180 degrees.
Must have been so shocking to you.
You know, what's strange is, on the one hand, it was shocking, but on the other hand, I was now in a new home in my heart.
Wow.
And so now this was who I really was. And so I would spontaneously get up 5 a.m. every day and meditate. It went on day after day after day. I'm doing it still today. And it's because I knew now that just under the surface of my awareness was this quiet ecstasy simmering. And I tapped it once. I knew I could tap it again.
So this experiential aspect of that blitz, right,
yes,
into your heart space, what you're describing is a complete transformation.
Yeah.
How did your, do you mind me asking, how did your friends, your colleagues, your family, how did they respond? How did they react to this new you?
That's a very good question. I would say, first of all, that my colleagues in neuroscience didn't really even want to hear about it. If I would even mention the word meditation, let alone near-death experience or something of that sort, I could see this veil come over their eyes, and I could feel them literally feeling like they were backing away from me energetically or even taking a step. And I could even see fear in their eyes. And I wondered at first, why are you so afraid about someone sharing something like this? And I realized it's because I was the same way before I had that experience. As a scientist, you have a worldview that you believe is absolutely true. And that person is trying to question your worldview that you know cannot be questioned. And it's very frightening.
It's such a perfect example of how our belief systems actually define us.
Yeah.
And when they're challenged, it's like, who are we? We start asking these questions about not just the belief system, but who are we? How can we make that transference into this new belief system that we're being called to? I refer to that as the call for love. And it happens in most often ways that we wouldn't necessarily choose, but it always manages to make its way in. In fact, I call it the heart shift. That's really the basis of my work, because it is so profound. From my perspective, we're actually shifting, changing the vibrational frequency of the heart energy. And what you're describing is fantastic. As you were speaking, I just need to share with our audience also that that feeling, those God bumps that I was feeling, it had started out very sort of a little more superficially on my skin, and then it just went from the top of my head right down to the tips of my toes and right back up again. It was like, woo, I got such a rush. So tell us more. Like, what happened as you really started to embrace this? And by the way, I just want to say also that I commend your courage, because being in that scientific community as you were, and obviously, as a woman, I'm certain you had to work really hard to get to where you were, to even get the validation that you were a scientist, as all the other scientists were, and more. I commend you. Great courage, and it really speaks to the spirit of who you are and your ability to come from that higher place.
It's awesome. Thank you. And I should say that in the beginning, it was very hard. I led two separate lives because my neuroscientist friends didn't want to hear about it. And it was finally after about 25 years of living these two separate lives and telling different experiences to my friends who meditated and my friends who were scientists that I said, this is driving me a little bit crazy. I feel a little schizophrenic doing this. And I need to start putting these two sides of myself together. That's when I began doing research on meditation in my own laboratory.
Wow.
And then my graduate
Wait,
students...
Wait, so what year was that?
This was in about the year 2000.
Fabulous.
That I started to do
wow.
this. And I found that, in fact, it was a wonderful new way of saying, okay, what can I learn about meditation from my scientific perspective that can work in harmony with what I've learned from my own experience and other people's experience? And I did that for a while, and I then began to realize that I also wanted to try to write a book that would begin to put all of this together in a broader framework. And that's when I started working on my book, probably about maybe 7 years ago now, titled Infinite Awareness, The Awakening of a Scientific Mind.
Wow.
And I wrote that in the beginning just for myself to
Could
say...
Could you just repeat the title
yes.
just for our audience?
Infinite-
I want them to make certain they go out and buy this book.
Infinite Awareness, The Awakening of a Scientific Mind.
Fabulous.
And what's happened then is that even though I wrote it for myself, I realized that as other people read it, they said, oh, that's what I also needed, because I also was feeling like I had these two separate halves of myself, my culture that tells me everything is materially oriented and my own higher understanding, and I want to understand how they can fit together. And so they've actually said, thank you, because you're helping me understand as well.
Wow.
So I appreciate that. And I should say also in terms of the courage, when this book was about to come out, I had two graduate students left in my laboratory that were going to be finishing in about a year. And I said, I'm warning you that once my book comes out and they people hear that I'm also a meditator and interested in spirituality, they may say that I've lost my credibility as a professor and you may have to deal with that. My students very sweetly just laughed and said, we know you're a great professor, it's okay. And I know that there's probably been a little bit of that, but a lot of people also are neuroscientists that when they see I've written that book, come out of the closet themselves and they say, oh, by the way, I'm also a meditator. So I realize it allows other people to step forward with their own
giving
courage.
Them permission to be
permission.
Authentic as you were being.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's, you know, such a gift to give another person and to give, especially those that are in the scientific field, because I believe that we all have experiences, but the difference is that it really requires each one of us to say yes, to allow them to come to the forefront and to acknowledge them.
Yes.
And so often, as you know, in the scientific community, as you described, it's like just this tunnel vision, right? We have to do it like this, 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 and this. And then there's no space outside of that for the curiosity that you described, the exploration of this incredible consciousness that we're a part of. So thank you. Thank you so much for that.
And you raise a really interesting point, too, because I realize that very often a scientist will have a spiritual experience or a near-death experience, and instead of being curious and saying, what really is this, they say to themselves, I must be going crazy. That was a psychotic experience. I need to put that aside.
Oh.
And that's where they sadly make their mistake. Instead of acknowledging this and exploring it and finding out if others have had it, they simply basically shove it aside and go back to their materialist perspective, and they lose this beautiful, sacred experience they've had.
Which, of course, as we know from our understanding, is actually meant to take them out of that box, out of the comfort zone. And unfortunately, I've also seen where, rather than even going back to where they were, they actually shrink down, because then they become very protective and, like you said, so afraid of being judged as crazy for having this experience, when in fact, we know spirit's going to be relentless. It's just going to come and keep knocking you over the head, tearing your heart out of your chest, and it is relentless until we open to it and recognize that we're in partnership.
Yeah.
So, okay, more. Give us more.
One of the other things then that I began doing is looking at research on near-death experiences and looking at the scientific validity behind those experiences. And I should say, when I was a materialist scientist, I thought there was no research in this area. As soon as I began to look in the research journals and look on PubMed, which is this national archive
right.
of scientific data, I found there were many, many, many studies that were carefully designed and showed that near-death experiences occurred when the heart was not beating, when the EEG was flatlined, meaning your brain was offline, and people were above their body watching everything down below them, and there was example after example of these very carefully designed prospective studies, meaning they look at everybody coming into the hospital from a particular point in time for like 4 years, and these are published in the best journals like Lancet Journal. And I'm saying, how did I miss this before? Only because I had tunnel vision and I wouldn't even look to see if there were data to support it.
Yes. Well, because it never entered your consciousness. And again, we're back to that vibrational frequency you can only bring in from where you are.
Yeah.
And we see the evidence of that over and over and over again. So I just want to make the distinction. You did not experience your own NDE. Is that correct?
That
and
is
by the
correct.
Way, for our audience, that means near-death experience. So you have not actually experienced that under traumatic circumstances. However, I know that you would describe some very similar experiences through your meditation. Can
Exactly.
you tell our audience about that?
Yes, I think one of the things that has happened to me as I've continued to do this research on near-death experiences and on meditation is I found out that the experiences are very, very similar. A spiritual awakening, when this energy arises within you and begins to fill your entire being and you move beyond your awareness that's limited to your physical body, with exactly what happens to somebody that has a near-death experience, where they also move into another realm of expansion and beauty. And in looking at the two phenomena, I see they are like two different ways at coming at exactly the same thing.
Mm.
So you don't have to have a near-death experience to have that happen.
Such important information. Because I've often heard people say, I wish I had what you had. I wish I had a near-death. I said, no, you don't.
Yeah.
You don't, and you don't need to.
Yeah.
It's accessible to you outside of that.
Yeah.
That was what happened with me. But maybe it's because I wasn't paying attention to what was happening before that. It's like, we're going to get her one way or another. But so tell us about that.
Yes, I think first of all, it's important for people that have had a near-death experience to understand that, because sometimes people say, that was the most beautiful expanded state, and now I'm back in this world, and I want that back again. And of course, they don't want to die again to have that necessarily. They'd like it here. And I think what the message that people are trying to get out now that have understood this, and Eben Alexander is a beautiful example,
oh,
the man who wrote
no,
Proof of Heaven.
He's fabulous.
And in fact, he will be speaking on Friday, I believe, at this meeting, or Saturday. Anyway, what he was saying too is it took him 2 years after his near-death experience to finally understand that meditation was his way back into that expanded state. And he said, not just so that he could relive the near-death experience, but so that he could go into deeper and deeper levels of consciousness
right.
inside of himself.
Self.
Exactly.
Perfect.
And then in talking and interviewing with Bettina Payton, an MD who had a near-death experience and had the same thing happen where she found it again, that expanded state through meditation, I'm realizing that that's one of the messages I want to get out to people who've had the NDE. Begin to meditate and be patient with yourself. I had one woman come up at this conference and say to me, Marjorie, I've tried meditation a little bit, but I don't seem to be going anywhere with it. And I said, it takes patience, like anything. Like any athlete trying to learn a new skill, you can't just do it for 10 minutes and say, I didn't get there and stop. It's something that you practice a little at a time, day after day, and meditation teaches you meditation. And you go deeper and deeper, bit by bit.
That was beautiful. That was beautiful. Meditation teaches meditation.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. I've never heard it said like that before. Thank you. So let me ask you a question. Why do you think it's important? And now this is both from a scientist and from this expansive consciousness, both your personal experiences. Why do you think it's important to do the research, to explore the NDE experience?
I think it's important for a number of reasons, but one of them is that because scientists are considered the elite of our society in terms of their knowledge and their theories and their structure, we need to actually show to the scientists with their own research paradigms and their own observations and data that these experiences are valid, that we have very accurate data showing that they're valid. The more studies we get done in that way, published in highly respected peer-reviewed journals, the more scientists will have to say, oh yes, you know, I now understand that we can't deny this. The other reason is that those people that have had the NDE often will discount it because their doctors and their families say, this couldn't have happened, you were hallucinating.
Hallelujah. I am so happy you brought that up. It's so traumatic for those who have experienced this depth of consciousness to be just dismissed by those around them. It's bad enough when it happens with family and friends, but when it also happens with, as you said, the scientists, the doctors, medical personnel who you're looking to for, first of all, compassion, number one, understanding, but also some validation, thinking, certainly I'm not alone here. There have to be others who have experienced this, and you get a door closed in your face. It's horrific.
Yeah. And especially because then when your doctor says, in fact, one woman told me this is what her doctor said. He said, if you mention that experience one more time, I'm going to send you to the psychiatric ward for recovery.
I've heard that over and over.
And I'm thinking then what you do is you shut down and you won't share it with anybody. And you're frightened because people are telling you you're crazy.
Yeah. And then you start to believe it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And like you said, you just continue to separate from the very people who you're looking to for comfort and so, understanding.
And one of the things that I think I love about the IONS meeting is that they are reaching out and making videos for medical schools to train new doctors so that when a person tells them of their near-death experience, they will have the words to use not to shut the person down and tell them that they are crazy, that they will actually encourage them to talk about it and share it with them with a totally supportive atmosphere. I think that would change so much if every doctor could simply do that much.
I agree with you, and I think one of the things that makes IONS so powerful as an organization, first of all, I mean, as we can see, it's growing leaps and bounds, which tells us that there are millions of people around the world who have had these experiences or know someone who have had these experiences or have wondered about the experiences. And we need to provide for them this place where they're safe, this place where they are safe to express, to explore, to discover, but also to just be authentic and to be able to be that expansive consciousness that we're all really yearning for in our hearts. And I think that IONS does do an incredible job at sort of creating platforms for almost any one of those people, right, to come and find that home, that home within their own hearts.
Yeah.
How do you think that this has changed how you relate to people and how people relate to you?
Wonderful question. First of all, I should say that when I was younger and a scientist, I thought that scientific research was the most important thing in the entire world. And I gave my energy to my research more than to my friends and my sweet husband and the rest of my family. I was so locked into that material exploration of the world. And once I began to meditate, and as I continued to dive into it and now really write this book, I have begun to see how, yes, learning about the world is important, but relationships with yourselves and others, the love that you experience between each other, is so much more important. And that's the final line. It's like, how much love can I offer and receive? Because that's the essence of a human being.
So powerful. I'm going to ask you for two messages. The first message I'm going to ask you for is a message to the scientist who is still closed off to these possibilities and is very rigid in their need for everything to be validated through that scientific method. And when something cannot be driven through that method and found to be substantiated, what do you have to say to them?
I think I would say to that scientist, simply be curious and be open to looking carefully at the data, and then make your judgment. And remember that William James, who was the father of modern psychology, was very curious and open, and he came to a new understanding himself of science that included both perspectives within it. Mm-hmm. So I say, give that a chance, be curious, and look carefully at the data.
So there is a place for science and spirituality to not only merge, but to develop their marriage, right?
Exactly.
We can coexist and actually live and work and celebrate life together.
Yes.
And about our audience, what's the message that you want to leave them with?
I think that they can trust their own experiences. They have to remember to
trust it
and not let other people tell them this couldn't have occurred. Listen inside, and then they also can read more of these books and come to conferences like the IANS conference. I should say that going to a conference like this, hearing so many other people with similar experiences and feeling the energy of the conference, it makes you really understand at a deeper and deeper level the absolute truth of your own experience as well.
So you use the word truth, and up they pop again. Through my body, I'm feeling the electricity of the power of those words. And truth sets us free, doesn't it?
Truth sets us free.
Yeah.
Yes.
Would you mind just repeating for our audience also the name of your book?
It's Infinite Awareness, The Awakening of a Scientific Mind. And again, I'm Marjorie Wollacott.
Thank you so, so very much. This has really been a privilege and an absolute delight to be here with you.
Thank you.
And again, for our audience, it's Marcy Newman, your host of HeartShift Radio. And you can find this podcast, obviously, and many others at www.heartshiftcoach.com. Have a wonderful day and so many blessings of great love to you all. Bye-bye.